The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Allegra Stratton.
And I'm Tom Clark. This week, as Egypt teeters on the verge of revolution, ageing dictators in the region have been wrong-footed. But so have Western governments.
The new cabinet appointed by President Mubarak this week is disappointing in that it does not constitute the broad-based representative government that the people of Egypt seem to be seeking, and we continue to make this clear to the Egyptian authorities.
Can Britain offer anything more than platitudes to those who line the streets of Cairo?
Also this week, a major new policing website is rolled out offering a street-by-street view of crime statistics. Open government or too much information?
And as a row blows up over plans to sell off the country's ancient forests, is the government failing to see, I'm sorry for this, the wood for the trees?
Joining us to discuss all this is The Observer's Raphael Baer, and also with us this week is our foreign affairs expert Martin Woollacott, and back for the second week in a row is The Guardian's sage columnist, blogger, and for this week, diarist, Mr. Michael White, and a warm welcome to you all.
Yesterday, as violence erupted between supporters of Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak and demonstrators against the regime, Western governments looked on rather powerlessly.
And going forward, the United States will continue to stand up for democracy and the universal rights that all human beings deserve in Egypt and around the world.
The key question is, have they done enough? Now, President Mubarak says he is going, and we respect that, but what matters is not just the orderly transition, but also that it is urgent, it is credible, it starts now. And the more they can do with a timetable to convince people that it's true, the more I think the country can settle down to a stable and more democratic future.
Martin Cameron, they're urging restraint on both sides. Can he do more, or is he at the sort of limits of his kind of diplomatic power?
The problem is that in public at least, he, just as President Obama is straddling the issue. He's saying that there's a need for a timetable. He's saying there should be an orderly transition. What he's not doing is responding to the demands of the anti-Mubarak crowds that Mubarak go now. I mean, after all, the man who is, for good or ill, the leader or at least the spokesman of that anti-Mubarak movement, Mohamed El-Baradei, has said nothing can happen, nothing can be talked about until Mubarak actually not only steps down, but leaves the country. So Western governments are not reacting to that. They're evading that issue. It's too difficult for them.
Why? Because if he stays, they've got to deal with him.
I think it's more that they do want to see a kind of discussion and negotiation between the regime in Egypt without Mubarak, or with Mubarak at one remove, and the new forces. They don't want a completely new sheet. They're careful not to say that, because that's also an embarrassing thing to say.
But, Raph, can they do anything? Yesterday in our comment pages, we had Simon Jenkins very eloquently making the case that Britain really can't hope to do anything much apart from make things worse.
Well, there's certainly no material intervention that you can imagine doing to change the facts on the ground, but I wouldn't underestimate the importance of being remembered in the future as having taken the position of moral authority at the right moment. I mean, there's been a lot of comparison with the collapse of the Soviet Union, some of it a bit overblown. But I was just remembering the other day how a terrible diplomatic mistake that was made by George Bush Sr. towards the end of the Soviet Union, when he went to Ukraine and he said to the crowds, just hold on, you don't want independence yet. There's some very important other issues going on here. Now, the people of Eastern Europe didn't forget that. They didn't forget that at a crucial moment there was a sort of power play had gone on and there'd been a bit of hedging. You know, if there's a bunch of people in the street saying we want democracy now, you will have more soft power certainly accruing to you if you're on their side.
Mike, where are you on this?
Well, it's an extraordinary thing to watch. It always is. We've seen a lot of it in the last 20 years, the velvet revolutions of Eastern Europe. Some people have used that analogy. 2011 is 1989 in the Arab world. That's a pretty buoyant and upbeat thing to say, knowing, as we all do, that things can go horribly wrong. They did, in a way, in Tehran in 1979. You ended up with an oppressive, essentially theocratic regime. Martin will nuance that point for me in a moment, since he knows a lot about Iran. You can see why why the Western powers are interested in stability. It's not just cynicism and a concern for the two-thirds of the world's known oil reserves in the region and the domino effect and things. But, you know, you don't want people to get hurt, and chaos and civil disorder is very nasty and can take a lot of time to put together. So they sort of finesse it. They decide a few days ago, perhaps a bit late, that Mubarak should go quite soon. And then they begin to realize quite soon isn't enough. Mubarak mistimed that broadcast, that concession. And then there'll be other elements in the security hierarchy probably saying, let's get the boys out on the street. We can sort out this bunch of middle-class characters out on Tahrir Square in a few days, and that'll probably prove wrong. It may not prove wrong. We're still at a sort of choreographed event, which the end of which is far from certain.
Mike, what do we know about Cameron's disposition on foreign affairs? I mean, is it the sentiments that Raf and Martin have talked about in terms of come on, seize the moment?
He doesn't know much, really. I think it's the general view. He's not particularly good at foreign affairs. We're seeing him this week sort of having to retreat on a previous retreat over a European court ruling regarding prisoners' voting rights in Britain. And he's new to it, and it's difficult. And, of course, he's one of Thatcher's children. He's a Eurosceptic. He's a bit suspicious of foreigners. So I don't think either he or Haig, they've been a bit disappointing. They haven't made any particularly egregious errors, but you don't feel you're dealing with people who know stuff too much.
Do you think, Martin, that Haig, do you get that same sense of a lack of sureness of touch, just in a lack of experience maybe in the particular noises you got from the British government over the last week?
I think there's just such a distance now between Britain and any capacity to influence events overseas, and not only in Egypt, that any British leader, except under special circumstances, usually in the context of doing something with or occasionally against the Americans, can't have the same kind of effect as in the past.
And you're listening here to a man who wrote a book about the Suez adventure the last time we tried in Egypt.
The last time we tried in Egypt, yes. Well, that's so incredibly distant, it could be centuries ago rather than half a century ago. I think the Simon Jenkins position that we mustn't act in these situations because any action is both irrelevant and it's not our business. The problem with that theory is that when you don't act, you're also intervening. And that's what Washington's dilemma is, and to some extent the European Union's, the governments of the European Union. The Americans have the lever of their close relationship with the Egyptian military and the money they give to the Egyptian military, which essentially sustains them and, through the Egyptian military establishment, sustains the Egyptian system and would sustain it with or without Mubarak. It sustained it before Mubarak and may sustain it in a new form in the future. They, therefore, can intervene. And I'm sure their messages to the Egyptian military are a very important factor in how this situation will play out.
I'd pick up on what Mike said actually as well, the extent to which I'm sure coming into government, one of the things that the Conservatives have realised is that the Eurosceptic positions that were nurtured over a long period in opposition don't really gel very well with the sort of practicalities of modern diplomacy when you're trying to exercise this soft power. And it puts Britain in quite a lonely place now when you think about who are our natural friends and allies for wielding influence, if it's not military influence. Because the fact is, the way you effect change in some of these countries is through the promise of some kind of enhanced trade or economic relationship. This is how you've had leverage over Turkey for a long time, is through the offer, in some senses bogus, of European Union membership. But the only way Britain really has anything to actually offer North Africa to say, yes, come into the fold of democracy, behave in a different way as a state, is through the European Union.
Can I ask my better informed colleagues here, indeed any of you, is the history of secular Turkey and the Turkish military and the evolution of civil government in Turkey got anything to illustrate and guide the Egyptians here?
Well, the obvious parallel, or the obvious thing to look into, is the conversion of what was once a fairly strongly Islamist party into a party which, although it's not lost touch with its Islamist roots, is in some ways like a normal centrist conservative
party.
This is
the ruling government in
So the question is whether that is that Turkish example is an exception, or whether it could be the model for Islamist parties or Islamic parties, Islamist is the wrong word here, I withdraw that, Islamic parties in Arab countries. And that's an open question.
It's tricky because, sorry to interrupt, but the AK party, the AK party in Turkey, at least was sort of nudging its way into a kind of pluralist political party system, which isn't really the case in Egypt. So, I mean, you would hope that, you know, the AK party is the model for something like Christian democracy in Europe, but the Islamic version, but there isn't, doesn't seem to be any other party anywhere in the Muslim world that,
of course,
that can follow that.
Turks are Arabs.
So just to be more direct about it in Egypt, Martin, what's your assessment of the, I mean, obviously there's a debate about the level of support the Muslim Brotherhood have anyway, if it were to really be tested at the ballot, but what's your assessment of where they have travelled on the moderate scale?
They've travelled quite a long way, but they're still divided. They have those who follow their affairs closely say that there is very clearly a liberal, moderate wing of the movement. The Wasat party, which is a political arm, is particularly exhibits that. They are ambiguous on questions which are absolutely core for them, like women's rights and the Sharia, but they are moving and they have moved. The question is not are they moving or have they moved, but how far can they move? There are certain parameters that an Islamic party has, which is very difficult to
And they are their
reach.
Attitude to Israel or...?
I think the attitude to Israel is not in itself an Islamic issue. It's another matter.
But just to, it surely it is important whether they believe in Israel's right to exist or is, I mean, doesn't that become the kind of key test for the Americans? Or
I think the double message that the Muslim Brotherhood has given out in the past, but this has been very mixed, is that on the one hand they wouldn't upset the current diplomatic situation, which is, you know, kind of shorthand for saying we wouldn't overthrow the treaty if we were ever in the position to have the influence to do so. But on the other hand, we see the future of Jews in the Middle East as citizens of our states rather than in their own separate state.
Right, we're going to have to leave that one there for now. But for more on this very fast-moving story, go to guardian.co.uk/world.
Well, it cost 300,000, we think, but on launch day it was receiving up to 80 million hits an hour, worth every penny. No surprise that the Home Office has hailed its new online crime maps a success. You type in your postcode and up pops a map of your area, complete with all the instances of burglaries, violent crimes, car crimes and so on, very neatly labelled. But where there are government statistics, there's usually a row about damned lies, and police have been forced to admit that some of their figures were false or misleading. Mike, where are you at on this crime map? Were you one of the first online? I bet you were.
Well, I logged on out of malice, knowing that it would have crashed by the time I typed in my postcode. And, of course, it had. I never got near my postcode. My instinct, of course, is information is always good. The more we know, and that's true of the people in the street in Cairo, as it is people in Glover's Close Preston, which was the place which got, at least in the Guardian's version, got picked on as the most crime-infested street in Britain. Needless to say, that was a surprise to the people of Glover's Close and all the other places which TV crews headed to at great speed. I have a problem with this, which is a familiar one that you create in our kind of society with this extraordinary capacity of technology to convey vast quantities of information, not all of it to Julian Assange. The problem is you get asymmetry of information, as with hospital lists, the performance of hospitals, the performance of specialists, people who know a way around their system, people with broadband, people with education go and say, well, I'm certainly not going to that hospital or that doctor, I'm certainly not going to move into that neighbourhood. Some people can't do it, some people can't access it, but we know the people who will, which will be insurance companies and estate agents and other people like that. And if you get a bad reputation, deserved or otherwise, courtesy of the police website, you're going to make people living in difficult circumstances living in that little bit more difficult circumstances. I wrote that on a blog and I got heavily criticised for it, so I may be wrong.
Martin, were you one of the 18 million?
I couldn't find out the dark side of my street.
Well, there wasn't one, or you did.
Wasn't available. But I very definitely agree with Mike that the problem with this kind of mapping, as with postcode lottery kind of things in general, is context. context is usually lacking. And so you get the authorities or services, public services, chased down and blamed for spikes or, you know, hotspots, which are explicable only really, genuinely and properly, in terms of all kinds of factors, social and political. And it's too simple, and it leads to a kind of shallow understanding of where we live and who we are.
Raf, I mean, as a journalist, every instinct in your body is going to be saying, yes, more information is good. But as with WikiLeaks here, we're seeing this triumph of a kind of bare-all mentality. Is something getting lost in the process?
Well, certainly, as Martin and Mike said, the context, I mean, just with any statistics down, as has always been the problem with crime statistics, down to the question of who's reporting the crimes and what it is that impels people to think it's worth bothering to report the crime, which might vary in different areas in terms of how much confidence people have in the police. But, I mean, I noticed that there was a burglary on my street since December 2010, and it prompted a slightly sort of misty-eyed, nostalgic thought in my head, which was that why didn't I know about that from the street? It's sort of in place of community. Why do we need to have CCTV and these digital interactions? I mean, that information should have been transmitted to me over the fence rather than through the proxy of a server in the Home Office. So that was sort of one feeling I had. The other is that so much criminal justice policy is driven by the fear of crime rather than the facts of crime. And so you have this dilemma in the policy like this, which is, on one hand, the fear of crime, it generally isn't a very effective way of mobilising good criminal justice policy because it's not very scientific, it's not very coherent. On the other hand, the police are the last great, big, totally unreformed public service, and anything that puts pressure on them to just get a bit better at doing what we're paying them to do has got to be a good thing. I'll have to wait and see. I haven't decided yet how I feel.
So sounded like a call for elected police commissioners.
Yes, yes, which you're going to get.
Not
Raph.
Sure about that.
Does this tie into this, Mike? I mean, is the idea you expose a local problem and then you need this local solution?
Well, it is a sort of populist style of governance, in which the elected police commissioner taps in these into this website and says, hey, we're not doing enough in Glover Close Preston. Why am I picking on Glover Close Preston? And we must do something. And the local paper says yes. But as Raf says, it's not the best, necessarily the best way to go about your business. The plural of anecdote is not data, as I heard somebody say quite recently.
On our street, this is The Guardian, we've got 4 cases of antisocial behaviour. That's not editors. 2 of violent crime and 3 of other crimes. Mike, what do you do with that knowledge? Now we know that. What do we do?
So you mean the street we're in here at The Guardian?
It's York Way, yes.
York Way, N1. Well, don't buy here, listener, is all I can say. It's obviously a crime-infested hovel, as the bits north of King's Cross often are. Of course, that's completely misleading, because the area north of King's Cross Station where we're sitting is in the process of a wonderful transformation. They're going to build art colleges when they get the money again and all sorts of things. So, as Martin said, a context is all. I live in a street that's got a bus route on it, so not much happens. It's quite busy. A couple of streets over, there's a rather smart street. Its crime statistics are almost certain to be worse than ours in a misleading way, because there's a little alleyway at the top which goes through to some sort of notorious estate. I'm talking in cliches here, but there's a slight mugging issue up at the top end of that street. But you need local knowledge and local context to understand all that sort of thing, and that'll be true for Glover Close Preston as well.
Has anyone yet looked at the city to see whether they map kind of serious white collar crime, massive transactional frauds?
No, it's not one of the 6 categories. And interestingly enough, they had to include sexual crime in the other crimes category, which I guess would include banker fraud, because they didn't want to identify victims of sexual crime. And that's another aspect of problems with these sorts of things. They're brilliant, but they're also dangerous.
Just finally on this, the coalition, Liberal Conservative coalition, hasn't been banging the law of order drum in the way that Conservative governments and indeed Labour governments have in the past. This is, in a way, one of the biggest things we've had from them on this area. Are they in danger of losing the plot a bit on it?
Well, I mean, politically, there's a difficult axis here because Ken Clark is doing his own thing in justice, and he's carving out his own slightly liberal, classic liberal Tory position on criminal justice, in spite of and to spite the right wing of the Conservative Party, as far as I can make out, which is a very sort of insular Westminster dynamic for forming policy. I think when Ed Balls was shadowing the Home Office for the Labour Party, he might have been more inclined to seize that opportunity to be a bit more pugilistic about it. What will happen now that Yvette is doing it? I honestly don't know.
I agree about Ken Clark. Theresa May, the Home Secretary, is a rather sort of mysterious figure. Nobody knows a lot about what she really thinks, apart from her dress sense. But there is, I think, part of the context, Raf, since that's the word of the moment, is a slight revulsion from Labour populism over crime. And Cameron, who worked in the Home Office for Michael Howard at one stage in his youth, knows a bit about the subject more than he does about Egypt, I think recoils slightly from these cheap shots. So that's part of the silence. But the right wing's getting cross about it. They're getting cross about a lot of things.
Well, if you can face getting cross, you can look for yourself at your own postcode at www.police.uk. I do hope you sleep afterwards, and once you've done so, let us know what you think on the blog. But now, an unusually sedate Prime Minister's questions. Yesterday, there was one issue that managed to raise the roof. Labour's Barry Shearman put the question to David Cameron.
Mr Speaker, 200 years ago, the privileged people in this country managed to steal the English common land from the English common people. Why is his government returning to that kind of activity by taking away the forests and woods of our country from the ordinary people?
I have to say, this government is taking a completely different approach to the last government. The last government sold off forestry with no guarantees of access, no guarantees that it was free, no guarantees about habitat. Now, of course, I'm listening to all of the arguments that are being put in this case, but I would just say this. Is it the case that there are organisations like the Woodland Trust, like the National Trust, that could do a better job than the Forestry Commission? I believe, yes, there are. What I would say to the Honourable Gentleman is there a problem when you have the Forestry Commission that is responsible for regulating forestry, but is also a massive owner of forestry? We don't accept that with the Bank of England or with other organisations, so this is worth looking at to see if we can produce a system which is actually better for access, better for habitat, better for natural England, and better for the countryside that we love.
Yeah. Raf, there's the chap who oversaw the change of his logo from a torch, a carbon-burning torch, to a lovely oak tree. He's sounding very shrill. Where does this leave Vote Blue, Go Green?
There's a serious sort of tin ear for politics, or bent antenna, I don't know what the metaphor is, has gone on here. And some of this, I'm going to mix my metaphors horribly here, it's kind of chickens coming home to roost. I don't think chickens roost in forests, but anyway, because what happened at the very beginning of this government is that the Conservatives, and David Cameron in particular, number 10, took enormous pleasure in saying, we're not going to be like Tony Blair, it's not going to be all this central command and control, there's not going to be a policy unit in number 10 that's going to tell the departments what to do, we're going to sit back, I trust my ministers, I trust my Secretary of State and departments to go off, we'll use the expertise of the departments. They go off, they come up with this stuff, and some of it's big stuff like the NHS reforms that they didn't see coming, some of it's these sort of little things like the forests or school sport in education, they don't see it coming, suddenly it lands on them and they're thinking, who thought this up? Why did no one tell me about this? Why did no one see this coming? Oh,
welcome to government.
And I think it's actually, I mean, apart from it being a terrible policy and one they'll probably do a U-turn on, I think I sense it is prompting a quite urgent sense of reorganising how Downing Street gets a grip on policy now.
But Martin, is it a small... I mean, Raf says it's, compared to, say, the NHS, it's a small thing, but for a lot of the sort of conservation-minded Conservatives, it could be quite a big thing, couldn't it?
Well, I think for people in Britain generally, there are a number of institutions which represent something like the commons to which our MP was referring. Institutions which seem to them, they may not be exactly right about it, and in fact they're not exactly right about it in case of the Forestry Commission, seem to them to be out of the commercial realm, in the public realm, protecting the beauty and the assets of our country. The Forestry Commission was one of them, and although its record is mixed in the 100 years of its existence, in recent years it's been getting better and better. So how stupid can you be to take an institution which is working well, which people and on track to work even better, and which people respect and see as part somehow on the same spectrum of the sort of the Cameron big society thing, how stupid can it be to say, with all our other problems and for no financial advantage, we're going to smash this up? You've got to be mad.
But he's suggesting things like the National Trust could possibly take over. That's an also trusted institution, isn't it? It's not handing it over to bankers.
They're never quite completely mad. And I caught in Cameron's answer there a couple of interesting points. I didn't know that the Forestry Commission both produced and regulated. Why is it the other end of the newspaper industry, the stuff we write it on, has the same problem that we do, that we're a self-regulated producer? Because as Martin says, the Forestry Commission record isn't spotless. I think Julian Glover wrote a column in this newspaper the other day in which he said, well, you know, they planted too much monocrop pine and they destroyed too much historic woodland, ancient woodland. But as Martin says, they're doing better now. Where Dave was interesting and I thought inadequate was this sort of Woodland Trust, National Trust stuff is, you know, big society stuff, but it's sentimental because they need money to run. I think I read somewhere in the week that it costs about $36 million to run these operations, cost the taxpayer, which isn't a lot considering how much resources there, 30p each or something, not a great deal. And you just think, well, even if you handed it over to the Woodlands Trust, and they would need to be financially supported, just as the privatised railways need financial support. If it ain't bust, don't mend it. That's meant to be a sensible Tory adage.
But, Mike, I think, you know, the problem with the point that Cameron made there is that it's true of many institutions. For instance, the National Trust, which, of course, is not a government, an arm of the government, but nevertheless, the National...
Chairman Sir Simon Jenkins.
The National Trust both regulates and protects. It has a commercial arm. It earns money from the properties and the lands and the houses.
Becoming more so at the moment,
and there are arguments about that. It's not absolutely necessary, and it's really rather ideological to say that these two functions always have to be separated. And merging, you know, giving some of the forest land over to the National Trust, why merge two institutions which are doing perfectly well on their own, are doing their somewhat separate, definitely very separate jobs? Why merge them? It's, again, a silly thing to do.
But if we, I mean, there's this great focus, obviously, on the historic woodland, the 5% or whatever it is that's been there since time immemorial, and ancient deciduous stuff. But what about climate change? The other 95%, if they're saying we're going to hand this all over to timber merchants, doesn't that raise questions, Raph, about
is that what they're saying?
what we're doing on...
Well, they clearly seem quite determined and committed to say that this will not result in there being less forest. I mean, lots and lots. It would be politically extraordinary and quite catastrophic if they were to somehow acknowledge that what would happen is then, you know, mercenary men with swords would come and just cut down all the trees. So I'm pretty sure their political starting point is that cannot be an outcome that can be perceived to be coming out of this. But I think Martin's point about the ideology of it is very important, that there's a blind spot in the coalition or in certainly the conservative side of it, that they think, and I think generally in the public, they have won the argument about the deficit. Now, in their minds, that flows effortlessly into a load of questions of why is the state doing this? Why should the state be doing that? Why should the state be having a load of forests? It's not something obvious that the state should be doing in the 21st century. I don't think a lot of people who accept the argument about the deficit follow that next step and say it's therefore obvious that the state should be divesting itself of all of these things.
There's no money in it anyway.
Yeah, and they don't, I think, particularly some of the more ideological ministers like Michael Gove, but George Osborne, but Cameron to an extent as well. That's a step that they follow very fluently, and I don't think they're taking people with them on that.
Now, look, we've got a new Cameron spin doctor, Craig Oliver from the BBC. First day in the job, dealing with forests. How does he deal with it?
I think he says, Prime Minister, we're going to have to rethink this one. The political capital expended defending a policy which is very unpopular and doesn't generate much and will probably lead to bad results. Cry off. The policy can go to Germany if, like Mr. Mubarak, is going to Germany for an operation.
Well, that's it for this week. You can read more about all these stories on our website, guardian.co.uk. Our thanks to Michael White, Raphael Baer, and Martin Woodcott. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Alex Stratton. He's Tom Clark.
Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.